This is an ABC podcast.
More than half of Australia's electricity comes from coal, and that coal comes from communities which have been waiting for years to hear what's going to happen to them as we transition to new energy sources. G'day, it's Dave Marchese, and on Hack today, we're heading to coal country to hear directly from those affected. Also coming up on Hack, we speak to the family of an Indigenous teenager killed after his bike hit a police car in Sydney over the weekend. But first,
energy giant AGL is being targeted in a takeover bid by tech billionaire Mike Cannon-Brookes
on Triple J.
Billionaire Mike Cannon-Brookes is one of Australia's richest people, and he's also really vocal about the need for urgent climate change action. So it caught a lot of people off guard when it was announced that he was trying to buy Australia's biggest power company, AGL. The $8 billion takeover offer with another company, Brookfield, was on the condition that AGL would close down its coal plants by the end of the decade. But this morning, AGL rejected the bid. It said it's not in the best interests of shareholders. So is that it? Well, with me now is Mike Cannon-Brookes. Mike, welcome back to Hack.
Thanks for having me, man.
Where did this idea to buy AGL come from?
Look, it's something we've been looking at for a long time since they announced the demerger. So their current plan is to split into two companies, one with all of the dirty coal generating assets and one with all of the renewables and customer base. That plan came out about 8 months ago maybe, and initially didn't make a lot of logical sense to me. And then the more we looked into the economics of it, we didn't think it made economic sense either. And so that was sort of the seed of the idea. And then since then we've discovered other groups with the same ideas and some different plans and worked together with them and culminating in the bid over the weekend.
So AGL this morning rejected this $8 billion offer. It's pretty much said it's not good enough, it's not enough money, not value for shareholders. For those of us that don't know how big business works, is that it or do you go back with a bigger offer now?
No, we continue to work with the board of the company and with the shareholders and customers broadly to explain our offer, explain our proposal and our price and why we got to this point. And the shareholders ultimately, with the board of directors as responsible representatives thereof, have to be convinced that our offer has higher value to the shareholders or less risk than the alternate proposal. And we'll continue to work with the company to see how that progresses as we move forward.
So, Mike, can you explain how this would work? You want to close down AGL's coal plants by 2030, which means you'd be replacing them with renewables. How much would you be investing in that?
So there's a further $20 billion that we have earmarked across the transition funds to build the replacement capacity for those thermal generation plants so that we can close them down as we replace them and transition them across, right? So one of the advantages we bring is that capital and that being able to do it all under one roof, we're able to manage that transition a lot more carefully and also as a private company do it a lot faster. The end result of that will be lower power prices for consumers because we know that renewables are the cheapest source of energy generation. And so the faster we can get more of them into our grid, the faster we can deliver those lower prices for customers, be they households or all the way up to large industrial customers of AGL.
Because that is a big thing that people would be really worried about. What's this going to mean for power prices? Do you think that they will honestly go down?
Absolutely. Yes. The power prices currently are at their lowest level in 8 years because of our grid topping over 30% renewables, right? The coal and thermal generation plants we have are very expensive ways to generate power today. We have far better ways. A lot of these plants were built in the 70s and 80s when technology was very, very different to what we have today. So we have way cheaper ways of generating energy today. And the faster we can replace expensive ways with cheap ways, you can work out how we can average down and present that to customers as lower bills. The reason they're at their lowest prices in 8 years is because of the penetration of renewables in our grid.
What about jobs? We're actually about to hear from young people in the Hunter Valley who are worried about the lack of plans for these affected communities who might rely on coal or other traditional industries. Are jobs a priority for you as well?
Absolutely. It's always something one should be thinking of. So firstly, this transition, we can be very thoughtful about it. So we think on a net level, we'd create somewhere between 10 and 12,000 jobs. because these transitions require a lot of different jobs to happen, right? Whether that's installing equipment, whether that's in construction, whether it's in maintenance and management, whether it's in operations, whether it's in all the technologies required to come together to blend all of these new, more sophisticated power assets, if you like. So it's certainly something they should be concerned about. I think in the long term, we need each of those regions. It's something else I've been really working on. The regions that have traditionally had fossil fuel generation or fossil fuel mining are going to need long-term plans for that transition to happen. That's not something that I'm wishing for. That's not something that that's something that's going to happen. We can confront that reality and be thoughtful about how we move through that transition, or we can just ignore it and slam into it like a brick wall. I would suggest the latter path is a very, very dangerous one for people, and we should not be going down that way.
And we will speak about that a bit later in the show, actually. What about Australia's carbon emissions? What would this plan mean for our overall carbon emissions? Would it have a big impact?
A massive impact. So AGL is the single largest emitter in Australia. So it's about 8% of Australia's emissions come from one company. And if you want an order of magnitude there, that is larger than every single car on every road in the country today. That is larger than all domestic and international aviation into, out of, and around Australia. It is larger than the emissions of New Zealand or Sweden or Ireland as a single country. So the ability to transition that amount of emissions in a single company with the capital to go and do it is what's attracted us to this opportunity. It's an amazing chance to show that we can play a really significant part in decarbonising the world in Australia. It would be one of the biggest decarbonisation projects on the face of the earth as a single project. And that should get us excited as Australians that we can do this. We have all the technology to do it today. We believe our plan has the capital and the execution muscle, the people, the talent, the smarts. And we think we could get that done decades earlier than is currently the plan of record of the company.
Well, I imagine there'd be a lot of interest from governments in this because there's a lot of pressure on governments to reduce carbon emissions at the moment. Are you talking to state and federal governments about this? Is the federal government supportive of the idea?
Absolutely. Look, we're talking to both state and federal governments, New South Wales, Victoria, and obviously in the federal level. They're supportive of the general direction, I would say, broadly. They have a lot of questions, as governments should, and we're proceeding to answer all of the questions. We're very clear that the existing expectations that they have made, we fulfill. They're asking for the private markets to replace this generation. That's what we're doing, and we're bringing the capital and execution to prove we can do that. They're asking for, as we turn off thermal generation assets and turn on renewables and storage and everything else, that is managed as a replacement. We're saying we're going to do that at the same time. And at the state level, obviously, the New South Wales and Victorian governments have both done a fantastic job at building out renewable energy zones and plans for how their states are going to transition. And this plan of ours works directly into those two state-level plans to, as they upgrade the grid and then modernise it and look at industrial precincts, et cetera, we're very much in lockstep with all of them on that.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on it. Mike Kenan-Brooks, thanks for taking the time to speak with us on Hack.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening.
Hack on Triple J.
Mike Kenan-Brooks there, and we'll let you know what ends up happening with that plan.
Hack.
If there's no coal, there's no electricity. If there's no electricity, there's no food.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we've been hearing a lot about the future of coal lately from politicians, from a billionaire just then. But what about the communities at the heart of all this? The Hunter Valley in New South Wales is made up of a lot of towns that rely on coal mining and power generation for jobs. It's also where I grew up, so I know exactly what it's like. I know it might seem pretty black and white to people in the city, but it's a lot more complicated when it's your home and it's your family's future. Maybe you're in the coal industry. Are you worried about the future of your community? Let me know, 0439 757 555, or you can call in 1300 055 36. First, here's Bridget Murphy with a special report for Hack from Muswellbrook in the Upper Hunter.
This will be a tough day for workers, their families, and the community that has helped power our state for generations.
That's the New South Wales Energy Minister, Matt Keane, after last week's news that the biggest coal-fired power station in the country is going to close down in 2025, way earlier than expected. The Eraring Power Station is in Lake Macquarie, in the New South Wales Hunter region. The Hunter is sometimes called New South Wales Coal Country. After the announcement, a lot of people were worried about power prices and possible power outages, while celebrating it as a win for green and clean power. But a heap of people in coal country were asking one thing. What's this mean for my job? Eraring's closure announcement joins a few others. The Liddell Power Station in Muswellbrook plans to shut next year, and the Bayswater Power Station, which is literally across the road from Liddell, will be closed in 2033. There's a couple of hundred workers at each of the three power stations, but when you look at the coal game overall in the Hunter, the number blows up.
Coal is a massive contributor to the economy of the Hunter region, and that has probably peaked. So we're all starting to think about how we can diversify the economy.
That's Professor Roberta Ryan from the University of Newcastle. She's been looking closely at what's important for the country in new research called Why Regions Matter. She says there's more than 16,000 people in the Hunter directly employed in mining or in related industries.
It's an astounding thing to go to a coal community if you haven't been to one. The scale of the open cut mines is really breathtaking. I think people who don't live or don't have a lot to do with mining communities don't understand how dominant the mining companies are in those communities.
Energy analysts are telling Australia that we've got to get ready to add more closure dates to the bye-bye coal calendar if we're going to hit net zero carbon emissions by 2050. A reality that's got 18-year-old Meg Southcombe from Muswellbrook a little worried.
Definitely, it could be something that tips people over the edge.
Meg's not saying that for the hell of it. She's done a whole heap of research into mental health stress in her community, the Upper Hunter. So much so that one of her major Year 12 projects looked at a family's experience of their dad fighting depression. And the secret she kept for so long was that the family she researched was her own.
I remember I've come home from school some days and there'd be news that, you know, people in the mines being put off, and my dad and mum would sit out the back, literally where we are, stressing if they're going to lose their job and what are they going to do. That's what sent my dad into a spiral of depression.
Meg's fear for the mental well-being of coal industry workers as more jobs are likely to go isn't the only worry for young people in the Upper Hunter. Singleton is 40 minutes away from Muswellbrook and is 22-year-old Miles Egan's hometown.
Mining is an identity for a lot of people in this part of the world, and unless people with moments of transition recognise that and policymakers recognise that, it'll be really hard, I believe, to get the community buy-in necessary in order to make the transition a successful one.
Miles is looking into his community's relationship to coal at uni. His studies have shown him one clear thing. It's time to plan for a transition in Singleton.
As soon as South Korea, Japan, China, India no longer want to buy our product, then there's really nothing that Australia can do, no matter who's in government.
So what does Miles think is needed to do that?
Forward planning really that starts today to make sure that there's going to be new industries to accommodate people who may fall out of mining.
Mining is heaps personal for 29-year-old Dean Puckridge. He's a dad and works full-time as a trainee at Blackrock Industries, an Indigenous-owned mining company in Muswellbrook.
The mines do go. There's going to be a lot of jobs. Like, as my partner is a mine operator, if she doesn't have a job, we're not going to have any living area as it is, because we can't afford anything up here.
Dean says he hears everyone's worries for the environment when it comes to mining.
I understand that, I really do, but if there's no coal, there's no electricity. If there's no electricity, there's no food. There's no, you know, transport. There's nothing. It's a chain reaction.
But Professor Ryan says things are changing for a lot of young people on coal country. Over 50% agree it's time to transition to make the environment healthier.
There's clearly a strong recognition that coal is not going to be part of their future. And there's a real urgency in what we're hearing from young people about the importance of diversifying the economy in regional areas.
Hack on Triple J.
Bridget Murphy with that story from the Upper Hunter. And let's keep this conversation going. With me now is Jacqueline McCosker from the Australian Conservation Foundation. It campaigns for clean energy projects that protect local jobs. Jacqueline, thanks for coming on Hack.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're from Gladstone in Queensland, and that's a community that's linked not only with coal but aluminium, natural gas as well. Are there big concerns in your community about the future of jobs?
Oh, absolutely, of course. So I work as a community campaigner in Gladstone, my hometown, And essentially every day I'm having conversations with other locals like myself about the future of our local industry jobs. Because we hear stories in the news, we see reports our employers are decarbonising. So there's a big question mark of what does that actually mean?
Do you think there's a misconception out there that people in mining and energy communities don't support action on climate change?
Absolutely. I think that is a myth that it's time we busted. I am speaking to fossil fuel workers every single day. I am in a fossil fuel household. And I think the regions are really ready to get on and have a mature conversation about what's happening and not about what comes next. And the perception that we are opposed to that conversation is a bit outdated.
As we've just heard, a lot of communities' identities often centre around these industries. And, you know, like I remember in Muswellbrook, for instance, you drive into the town and there used to be this big sign like Muswellbrook powering the state. Like it was, people were really proud by, you know, what they were doing to keep energy going in New South Wales. How do you get locals on board if they feel really strongly about that part of their identity?
Yeah, I think there's an important point to make here that when we talk about energy transition, so many employees are working in industries that surround energy generation. Very few people are actually employed directly in burning coal for energy, but there are thousands of jobs, for example, in Gladstone, our largest employer is aluminium, and there are thousands of jobs employed in that industry that depend on a steady stream of energy. And there have been many studies, some including our own report from 2020, that show that decarbonizing our energy grid will actually protect those aluminium jobs by keeping the price competitive enough to compete in the global market. So when we're talking about energy transition, we're actually talking about job creation or job protection. I think that's a very important distinction than just that transition means jobs are ending.
What sort of action would you like to see from governments in terms of transition for communities like this?
Great question. I think the first place to start is a lot of what we need is acceptance and acknowledgement of reality publicly. I would like some people to step outside of their boardroom and talk to real people about our real lives. Because talking about the end of coal is not the same thing as attacking coal workers. There is no moral judgment implied towards somebody doing honest work. But the writing's on the wall, right? We've just heard that package that coal can't compete with its cleaner, cheaper competitor. So what are we going to do? We are calling on the state government to fund regional transition authorities based in the most affected areas, which can help guide those communities through their own unique challenges. And we're hoping beyond just high-level infrastructure or workforce planning, those transition authorities will also be equipped to offer very practical support and guidance for individuals on the ground. And we call on the federal government to coordinate a national economic transition plan that would incorporate all of these regional transition authorities in different states, because ultimately this must be a national strategy of decarbonisation.
All right, Jacqueline McCosker from the Australian Conservation Foundation, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
On the text line, some thoughts. Somebody says, surely jobs at coal-fired power station plants can be repurposed into other industries. Jobs are easy to solve compared to the future of our environment. Get some perspective.
Hack. That's my kid. I'm never going to see him again after today. You know, I just want to know the truth.
On Triple J.
The family of a 16-year-old Indigenous boy who died over the weekend have called for an investigation into his death. Dungutty teen Jai Wright died after hitting an unmarked police car while riding a motorbike, but his family say they've been told two different stories about what happened. His devastated family spoke to Hack today about the confusion around Jai's death.
Christy called me and I could tell in her voice that something was not right. And she just said, quick, hurry up. Jai's been in an accident, a motorbike accident. So I just knew something was wrong. I wasn't far from home, but the 5 minutes of thoughts were so hard to take.
This is Lachlan Wright, speaking to me outside Sydney's Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. He's recounting the moment he found out his 16-year-old son had had a serious accident.
As a parent, I was like, tell me he's just broken a leg. Tell me he's just broken his arm. Tell me he's had some stupid stack.
Less than 24 hours later, Jai was dead.
And then when we walked into the hospital, I saw the nurse, and you just know that it's something bad. You don't know how bad, But you know when you look in her eyes, and that's when we knew.
Police say on Saturday morning, officers saw two vehicles they suspected had been stolen, a black Mercedes and a trail bike. Cops spotted the bike, and around half an hour later, Jai, who was riding it, had hit an unmarked police car. He was pretty badly injured and was taken to the RPA. But Jai's dad says the cops who first talked to him at the hospital gave them a different story.
In the first version, it's from what the police said to me, the police officer turned in front of Jai like he wanted to stop him while he was riding a motorbike down the road, like he wanted to ram him. That's what it sounded like to me.
The details around the incident are a bit sketchy, and police say they can't talk about it while an investigation is going on. But Lachlan says there's a clear conflict in the first and second versions of the story he got from the cops.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. Jai Wright was our 16-year-old son.
This afternoon, the Wright family called for an independent investigation, away from the police, into the circumstances around the death of their son and brother.
As a parent, I want to know the truth about what happened to my son. I want to know how he died, why he died, if there are any circumstances that, you know, were a little bit off. I just want to know the truth about that.
Lachlan's asked to see the police notes and any footage from the incident, but says his request has been denied. He says an independent inquiry could help answer questions around why police were after Jai in the first place.
He's a 16-year-old boy, and when we're young, we all do some silly things, you know, so... But he's a good kid. He was a good kid. And no matter what anyone's done, no one deserves to die at that age.
Lachlan says he just wants his son's death to be treated like anyone else's would under the circumstances.
Aboriginal people deal with racism, you know, whether it be, you know, in Kempsey, where all our mob's from, whether it be, you know, up Bundjalung country, whether it be in Redfern. So you just want a bit of equality in regards to looking after our mob and making sure that, you know, we can thrive just as much as anyone else.
Lachlan wants Jai to be remembered as a kid who was just starting his life.
I just want Jai to be remembered as the happy boy that he was, you know, the friend of everyone, you know, the one that could make people laugh at the drop of a hat, you know, that could be a little bit annoying also for his brothers and for, you know, his family. At the moment, we're just struggling to see him not be able to talk, laying, you know, in a hospital bed with tubes, helping him breathe, and about to die. Or dead already.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Meghna Bali with that story, and production by Joe Lauder. And we had a message in, someone said, I taught Jai he deserved better than this. He had a huge heart for his mob and he'll be dearly missed. And we put detailed questions to New South Wales Police about the lead up to Jai's death, including questions about why he was pursued and what his family had been told. But they said it was part of a critical incident investigation and they couldn't provide any further information.
Hack. Belgian employees will now be able to work full-time 4 days per week.
On Triple J. Well, imagine how much better Friday would feel if it was actually the weekend, because that is happening in some parts of the world. Belgium has announced that it's switching to a 4-day work week. Employees are going to be able to trial it for 6 months, see if they like it, and then choose to either stay with the 4 days or go back to 5. And other countries like Spain, Japan, Scotland and Iceland, they're all making similar moves. So when are we doing it? Well, with me now is Professor John Quiggin from the University of Queensland. Thanks for joining us, John.
Good afternoon.
Happy Monday or Friday or whatever this will be if we change the dates. But why do we even work 5 days in the first place? Where did this come from?
Well, of course, we didn't always work 5 days. For most of certainly the modern history, we've worked 6 days, and Sunday was the only day off. It's only in the first half of the 20th century that we went from 6 days to 5 and got the weekend. That was 70 years ago, and I think we saw some more moderate reductions in hours for the next 30 years, most people expected by now we would be have a much shorter working week than we do. But that all came to a halt really in the 1980s, and we've had no reduction in standard working hours since then.
Right. So we have been hearing about a lot of countries making this switch. What are the benefits of switching to a four-day working week?
Well, it's one way of getting generally shorter hours and more time for people to spend. I think the pandemic has shown us very much that just because we've done things in a particular way for a long time doesn't mean it's the best way. And so it really is a matter of taking the benefits of increased productivity. There's been huge increases in technological progress in the last 40 years, taking some of that in the form of more time for ourselves rather than all of it going in terms of increased consumption of goods and services.
Emily says, as a nurse working long hours, I highly recommend doing longer hours and having extra days off. That's a good question. Would we be working less hours or more hours on the days we do work?
Well, there's various ways of handling it. But in the version of the four-day week I've looked at, we'd be doing more hours in the day, but less hours in total in the week. So we'd have slightly longer days, but only 4 days per week. I think that's a sensible, affordable way of getting us to a four-day week reasonably fast.
We're also seeing other things from countries like Belgium's also made changes in rules to crack down on bosses contacting employees after hours. Do you think that's a good idea as well?
We're already seeing that in some awards. I think the Financial Services Union has negotiated that. So that's a necessary follow-up to the shift towards working at home, that having got time, we have to ensure that that time is ours rather than the boss's.
Someone says, yes, please, Australia, four-day work week. Ben from Wollongong says, I'm telling you, still five-day work week, but late start on Monday, about midday, early finish Friday, about midday. So there's definitely some ideas here from listeners about what they'd like to see. How would we cope if people were earning less? Would that be an issue?
Well, there's no need for reduction in wages, in my view. We could move in the next wage case to a 36-hour week uniformly. Some workers already have that, and get a nine-day fortnight, then we could reduce hours further rather than taking wage increases. That would take a few years, but we could easily maintain current wage levels and have less work hours.
What about businesses adjusting to this? There'd be probably a lot of business owners listening thinking, oh, that would be way too hard to figure out. What would happen there?
Well, of course, nobody would have believed if you'd said on a Friday in March a couple of years ago, look, in 3 days' time, you're going to not be able to go into the office, going to start working from home, and by the way, look after your kids at the same time. People would have predicted, I think, that business would collapse. In fact, it went on, the kind of work that could be done from home went on just about without a hitch, of course, with plenty of stress for workers who had to look after kids as well. But the idea that just because we've done things this way for a long time, it's too hard and too difficult to change. I think the pandemic has really shaken people out of that idea.
And John, do you really think this is something that could happen in Australia now? We're seeing it in more and more countries around the world.
Well, certainly we don't have the leadership for it at the moment, certainly at the political level, but I think lots of people want it. We are seeing some progressive businesses move that way. We really need more of a push from the union movement. We got some of that with the Your Rights at Work campaign back in 2007, but we certainly need a big push. We need this to be a standard working condition. That's probably some years off in Australia.
Hack on Triple J.
That's Professor John Quiggin there, and that's all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.